Well, good morning. My name is Justin, and I'm one of the pastors here, and we're so thankful that you have come and worshiped with us here at Ecclesia. I know we have a lot of guests here in the room, and just for you guys who are native Utahns or have moved from somewhere else other than Texas, I just want you to know that Texans are invading Utah, okay? If you don't know this already, Utah is known as Little Texas, and so when you come and you get to know our community, you're going to get to see, you're from Texas. Did you and Justin know each other? In case you didn't know, Texas is huge, all right? That's why we want to be like our own country. No, we didn't know each other. In fact, if you're here and you're from Texas, it's most likely that we've actually met here. And so God is bringing Texans to redeem Salt Lake City. That's the way we see it. If you want to jump in on that mission, you just need to say a few yeehaw and y'alls, and you'll fit right in. And we'll even include the Oklahomans. Oklahomians? Oklahomans? Okies? Okay. Yeah, we have some Okies up front here too. So, we're so glad you're here. Thanks for coming and worshiping with us. We are in a series called Summer in the Psalms, and so we find ourselves in Psalm chapter 4 this morning, and we're kind of doing this journey through the book, and so next week will be Psalm 5, but we actually are not going to be gathering here next Sunday. At your seat this morning, we've provided a family worship guide, and what we've done is we want to intentionally encourage you to go out, engage your neighbors, friends. July 4th is a big holiday that people love to spend together, and we're not always necessarily trying to get people to come to church. We want to get people to go and be the church, and so next Sunday, we're actually not going to be gathering in this room, but the church is going to be gathering all across the city, and so we're encouraging you to take the worship guide. We're going to be at Psalm 5 next week, and so we're going to have a pre-recorded sermon that I'll be doing on Psalm 5, and if you look on the worship guide, this describes how to access that material, as well as some songs that are some great praises that you can sing along with that psalm, some questions you can consider. So if you have roommates, if you live with some of your friends, you got neighbors, you got family, whoever you want to consider your family, pull them together and say, hey, let's do this, let's walk through this. And the message that I'll preach next week will be brief, because we want it to intentionally be missional. And so we want you to engage your friends, family, neighbors with that. But we'll be at Psalm chapter 4 this morning. And I want to begin with a confession, okay? Confession time. I want to confess something to you. And for some of you, this is going to discourage you. For some of you, it might be motivating. For some of you, this might be challenging. This might like really set a fire underneath you and go, okay, I got something to do. But here it is. My goal in life, this is my confession, my goal in life is this. I want my kids to say, my dad is stronger than your dad. And I'm out to prove it to them. I want my kids to say, my dad is smarter than your dad. I want my kids to say, my dad is way cooler than your dad. And so it's a competition. And I confess that to you this morning because I'm out to get some of you, okay? I'm challenging you in this because I realize I do have a challenge. I got some great dads out there and some people that I really have to, you know, set the mark high, because when we get together with some of your kids and they talk about their dad, I got to make sure that my stories are better. And so, you know, I'm out going down the street on a longboard holding kids, like trying to, how can I be the coolest dad possible? That's my goal. It's a competition. And so I find myself doing a lot of crazy things. I do a lot of things where I tell my kids, hey guys, watch this. And I do something that's super awesome and I go, who's your daddy? And they're like, you are. All right, so they get it. They get it. They understand this. And the reason I do this is because I want my kids to grow up knowing the character, the nature, the strength, the power of their dad. so that they know that they got this dad in their corner. Like he's in their corner, he's for them. He's excited, he wants us to have fun. He's gonna make everything fun. And what I'm doing is I'm trying to teach them a healthy reliance upon dad. If they know dad is strong, if they know dad is smart, if they know dad, you know, can do things other dads can't do, then they're gonna be like, hey dad, I need your help with this. You know, like if there's some heavy lifting, you know, like we're not gonna go to the dad with toothpick arms, all right? We're gonna go to my dad, Justin, you know, like he works out and I know it doesn't look like it. Come on. All right, so they're gonna come and they're gonna say, hey, we can trust my dad. My dad's got power. My dad can do something. He can make something happen. My dad's smart. He can help me think through something. And kids are naive, and that's part of like the childlike faith. You know, every kid thinks their dad is the most awesome dad out there. So in reality, it's not that big a challenge because everyone, if we brought my kids down and we said, all right, Lottie, Kate, Jet, and Jackson, who's the best dad? Who's awesome? They'd be like, you, okay, great. You know, and I'll pay him later. But the thing is they fully trust me as their dad. They have a reliance upon me as their dad. And I've illustrated things to them in the past that have given them this understanding of knowing who I am as their dad. Paul Miller, in his book, A Praying Life, he says this, if you know your parent loves and protects you, it fills your world with possibility. You just chatter away with what's on your heart. And here's why, because when you know that there's not anything that's out of bounds, when you know that there's nothing out of limits, when you know, like, I can dream big, every possibility is on the table. Why? Because, like, my dad cares. My dad can make anything happen. And when they believe that about dad, when they know that we love them and we're protect them and we're for them, it's like, man, they can do anything. Because, man, I got my dad in my corner. My dad's gonna help me. And that's for me, like, that's what I want to create. I want to create that connection with my kids so they can know the character and power of dad. And like little children, that they can believe and they can put their hope and trust in dad. And I know that's a careful balance because ultimately I'm a dad that's human, meaning I'm going to fail. And I'm a dad who's going to sin. And I'm going to disappoint. But my job really is to point them to their better dad. My job is to point them to a better father. And we understand this balance because some of us have grown up with maybe unhealthy relationships with dad, or we just maybe didn't even know dad, and dad didn't really exist, dad wasn't in the picture, and we don't have a very good picture of dad, and because of that, we struggle to believe that God, the Father, actually loves us and cares for us and desires to bestow grace upon us and wants to see us, you know, succeed. He's for us, and we can't really understand that because we've grown up with this idea that that's not my dad, and I don't really have that visible picture of that being my dad. And so I got to paint this picture. I don't want to skew their picture or distort their picture of what God is like. But I'm to point them to a better dad. Every child believes their dad wants to provide good for them. But as you get older and as your kids age, eventually time goes on and you do disappoint as a dad. You do, there are broken promises. And more times than not, we leave sometimes these children, rather than hoping or dreaming, they're kind of going, they're doubtful. You know, they're doubting whether or not, you know, like, man, I don't know. Who do I have to go to? Who can I run to in this? And for me, I want my kids to keep dreaming. I want to paint a good picture of God the Father. And so what we see when we're jumping into Psalm 4, and the reason I set this all up is because David is being described here in a very childlike way, because it's all, he's talking about his dad. And you may read this and go, oh, I don't see the word dad here, but it's this picture of who's in his corner. It's God the Father, that God the Father and his nature and character is what's given him strength and power for David to continue to live the life that God's called him to live. And we're all called to have that dependence, or, you know, where we're like, we trust in God that, you know, when we read the Gospels, we see that Jesus tells us, I mean, he's got a heart for children, and he says if we're going to have faith, we want it to be like childlike faith. In fact, there's two places in Jesus' life where we see Jesus highlight the childlike faith of a person. In Luke chapter 7, where the centurion comes and he asks Jesus to heal his servant. It's on this occasion that he's like, hey, pay attention to this person. Luke 7:7. If you got your Bible, flip over, or you can write it down. Listen to this. Luke 7:7. The centurion says, therefore, I did not presume to come to you, but say the word and let my servant be healed. I mean, this is faith. He's like, just say the word. Just say it, and my servant's going to be healed. For I too am a man under authority with soldiers under me, and I say to one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes, and to my servant, do this, and he does it. And when Jesus heard these things, what did he do? He says he marveled at him, and turning to the crowd, all right, so he turns to the crowd. He's talking to this one man, but he turns to the crowd here, and he says, I tell you, not even in Israel have I found such faith. I haven't found faith like this in anywhere else. And it's almost like Jesus is saying, hey, let me highlight what this guy's doing here. I've not seen faith like this. This is the faith that God is calling us to have. It's a very childlike faith, a confidence, a belief, a bold assurance that we go, I know God will come through. And then we see the story of the Canaanite woman whose daughter is possessed by a demon. She keeps coming to Jesus. We see in her persistence. In her persistence, she has faith. In Matthew 15:28, says, great is your faith. It's very childlike. And what David here is, it's very childlike faith. What many believe about Psalm 4, and if you weren't with us for Psalm 3, you got to go back and listen to it to understand, because a lot of people say, all you know, like Psalm 1 and 2 somewhat go together, that it's almost as if Psalm 3 and 4 go together. In the early times, it was typically that Psalm 3 was a morning prayer and Psalm 4 was an evening prayer. And you'll see in Psalm 3 at the end of it, it talks about rising up. In Psalm 4, it talks about, in peace I lie down. And this was like an evening prayer. And so there's some continuity between Psalm 3 and 4. And we see that even some of the storyline behind Psalm 3, where he's on the run, David is on the run from Absalom. He's facing all of these, you know, great trials. He's facing persecution. And he's on the run out of Jerusalem. And he's weeping. We see some of that same storyline flow into Psalm chapter 4 when we see that he's constantly being criticized. He's constantly facing obstacles, and it seems like he's just in a tight situation. Have you ever been in a tight situation? In that tight situation, where did you turn? Where did you go? Who did you cry out to? Who did you go to for help? Was it a neighbor? Was it a friend? Was it a family member? David turns to God. And what he basically says is, hey, you can come against me. This is Justin's summary of Psalm chapter 4. You can come against me, but I don't think you know who my dad is. My dad is way stronger than your dad. My dad is way cooler, has more power than your dad. My dad's in my corner. He's fighting on my behalf. And you know what? I got his phone number. I can call him up, and he answers. He'll answer me when I call. And he has this confidence in this, and he's basically telling his accusers, hey, do you know who my dad is? Do you know whose ear I have the attention of? Do you know who it is that I talk to on a regular basis? It's the powerful creator of the universe. Nothing stands against him. And that's what David is putting his confidence in Psalm chapter 4. And so David finds himself in this difficult situation, and he turns to prayer. And one of the things we've talked about as we've walked through the Psalms is we said that the Psalms will help us articulate prayer. It'll help us understand what prayer is, what prayer looks like, because you're seeing the prayers of David. And by reading this and following through and meditating on this, we learn to pray. If you ask my kids, how did they learn to pray? They learned to pray by hearing mom and dad pray at the dinner table, by hearing mom and dad pray when we put them to bed. And so prayer is instructing. We're instructing people when we pray. I remember when I first became a Christian and, you know, you sit in that group and, you know, it's like, hey, it's a small group and, hey, Justin, why don't you pray? And I'm like, what is that? You know, I have no idea what that even looks like. And over time, you begin to learn because you hear other people that prayer instructs us. And so we're going to be leaning into this prayer and allowing this prayer to instruct us what it means to pray, how to pray, what it looks like to understand the character and nature of God when we pray. And so what does he do in this? He begins by pointing out a few attributes of who God is. He begins pointing out, and here's what, basically, I'm going to give you a brief outline, and here's what I would say for the first point is, remembering how God has rescued in the past gives hope and confidence in the present. I'll repeat that. Remembering how God has rescued in the past gives hope and confidence for the present. Remembering how God has rescued in the past gives hope and confidence for the present. And so David begins by describing three ways that he's seen God rescue in the past. He begins by describing three ways he's seen God show up. And this is almost like he's not doing this to get favor with God. This isn't like when you go to someone and like, hey, you know, I really like you, right? Yeah, you know, remember, you know, I think you're really awesome. And you're like praising them because ultimately you want to ask something of them. That's not David. That's not what he's doing here. So David's not like buttering up God so God will, you know, look upon him with favor and answer his request. No, he's just crying out. He's remembering how God has rescued. And he says this, answer me when I call. Now, when you listen to that, that sounds pretty bold. Like to talk to God in that way, God, answer me. Like it sounds like he's demanding, like it sounds like he has an authority over it, but what is really coming out in the psalm in verse 1 is that it's a confidence. It's a boldness and an assurance that he is going to answer. And he says, he's going to answer me because I've seen him answer me in the past. And he says, here's how I know that. He says, oh God of my righteousness. Now, hold on a second. David, righteous? If you were here with us last week, you heard that's not necessarily the case. Like, what about that whole David-Bathsheba thing? That righteous? I don't know that I describe him as righteous. So what happened here? Well, I think what's happened here, we understand now, because although David didn't fully understand, we understand because now we have the cross, and we understand what the cross means for us, and we understand what happened on the cross is 2 Corinthians 5:21, that he who knew no sin, Jesus, took on our sin. So God took our sin and put it on Jesus. It says, he who knew no sin became sin so that we might become the righteousness of God. Not anything that I went out and worked towards or accrued for myself. No, this is God's righteousness. And so what happened in that moment, this is the great exchange. The great exchange is my sin was taken from me and placed upon Jesus on the cross, and God's righteousness in Jesus was taken from Jesus and put upon me. So now when God looks upon Justin, because I've put my faith and trust in Jesus, and I trusted what he's done for me on the cross, is that God sees me in my righteousness. I'm righteous. And for some of you who've seen my life, you go, well, I don't know about Justin. I've seen, you know, I saw him cut that dude off in traffic the other day. I don't know that he's righteous, right? You know? These guys saw my patience yesterday as we waited in line to get into Hill Air Force Base to watch the air show yesterday. Like, I don't know if Justin's righteous, you know? Like, so we're wondering, how do we get this righteousness? It's a gift. God has given us his righteousness. And so he's claiming the fact that he is righteous on the fact that God has given him this righteousness. David wasn't righteous. David was not approaching God because he was righteous. He was acting on the fact that he had been called righteous. You don't have to do anything to be called righteous. It's a gift. Second thing he says is, you've given me relief when I was in distress. Now, what's interesting about this, I love how this word describes, this word relief describes the situation. What that word relief really means, Charles Spurgeon said, this is a figure taken from an army that is enclosed. And he says this, using language that I don't speak in regularly, but he says, God hath dashed down the rocks and given me room. He hath broken down barriers and set me in a large place. That word relief literally means he put us in wide open spaces, not like Dixie Chick's song, all right? But like, those of you from Oklahoma are like, yeah, all right? You know, no, he's given us this wide open space. And it's like, man, that is a great picture. That's a great picture of going, here I was in this tight situation. My enemy's closing in on me. I feel like I can't even breathe. You know, it's kind of the sense of being claustrophobic, you know? And you're sitting there and everything's closing in. And it says God gave him relief, meaning that God has picked him up and taken him and put him in a wide open space where he can breathe. And it's like, man, this is awesome. This is the type of relief that God wants to come in situations where we're like, man, what do we do? And then he says, be gracious to me and hear my prayer. We all need mercy and grace. We all need his grace to answer us and to bring this relief. And this relief is he wants relief from those that are chasing him. He wants relief from his accusers. When we read on, we're saying that people are shaming his name. He wants relief from that. He's like, people are slandering me and people are lying about me and people are saying these things and it's hurtful. And I want relief from that. And I think what I find interesting is this is, where do we go for relief? Where do we go to be taken out of that situation that just seems closing in on us and God picks us up and puts us in a wide open space? And I go, that relief only comes from him. Where do you turn to for relief? Other people? Jobs? Food? Addictions? Where do you go to find relief? Like, I just need to breathe. David goes straight to God. He's like, God, answer me. God, hear me. God, I'm calling out to you. We have a tendency, I think about it, you know, I thought about yesterday when I was waiting in line for hours. I'm going, man, it would be easy just to vent this to other people and go, man, we're waiting in line, you know, like we're sitting here and there's people cutting in front of me. You know how like traffic lines up in a long line and then like that one car goes all the way past the line and they put their blinker on to go right, you know, and they want to cut like 400 cars and you're like, you want justice? And you're like, what? No, you can't do this. And you know, I want to get out of the car and walk up there and be like, sir, I don't know if you know, but all these people are in line and you got to go to the end of the line. You can't cut, you know? And I think about this and I go, I want vengeance. I want justice. I want to teach that person a lesson. And I'm like, that's not going to really solve anything. In reality, I may feel better because I've gotten this off my chest, you know, and I've said, but no relief actually comes from that. And I share a silly situation, but in reality, that's exactly what we do. More than likely, there's a lot of times we go to people to vent. We go to people and it's like, man, how often do we just go to God? How often do we just say, man, this is what I'm experiencing. This is what I'm facing. God, help me. Give me relief in this. And the reason David could do that is because David had experienced God's relief in the past. Not only that, but he knew the story and history of Israel where in times past where God has given relief. I mean, just to run our mind through a few things, like think about Adam and Eve. They were in a pretty tight situation in the garden. God told us, we eat of that, we die. Now God's out looking for us. What do? We run. We hide. And in that situation, God gave relief. God gave grace. God gave mercy. He clothed them. I think about Abraham going up on the mountain to sacrifice his son. Talk about a tight situation. Taking his son up on the mountain and binding him up and putting him on the logs. And imagine just the sadness and fear. But man, tight situation. God gave relief. Think about Joseph, and you read all the last parts of Genesis. You see, Joseph was in some pretty tight spots. And Joseph was given relief. The Israelites, when they come up to the Red Sea and they see these Egyptians chasing them, it's like there is nowhere else to go. Tight situation. God comes in and gives relief. Daniel in the lion's den. Relief. Let's go on into the story of Jesus and go think about the relief that Jesus came to bring. That the human race is inflicted with this disease called sin. And because of our sin, we're separated from God and we're abandoned and we need relief. And Jesus goes to the cross to set us free. How has God relieved you? How has God been your place of relief? I'll share a brief story. When I was first planting Ecclesia and we were getting started as a church, I was in a residency program, and one of those events is they took us to this awesome place in Arkansas. I know there's awesome places in Arkansas. Yeah, this place was cool. It's called the Winchester Gun Club. So Mr. Winchester owned this ranch, and this is where they go, and presidents have come through and hunted on this property. It's a pretty awesome place. And what they did is they took us, there were seven of us as residents, and they came and they brought us to this ranch, and they brought in this guy who was a biblical counselor who was going to basically dive into our life over the next few days. And they got all of our personality tests, they got all of our, you know, gifts tests and skills, strength finders, so he had some insight as to who we were and what we believed our gifting to be, and but there was always one issue that he was going to engage and speak into. And I remember going through the whole week, I'm like, man, I don't think, what's he going to get me with? You know, like, I can't imagine, you know, like, and I'm watching my friends go one after one and tearing up and crying and going, man, I never saw that in my life. And I'm like, this is crazy. You know, like, surely maybe I'm the one, you know, like, I don't have any issues and this is going to be good. And I remember the last day, it's coming up to time where we're going to leave, and I'm like, great, I didn't have to go. And I'm glad I did. What they had us do is they said, hey, I want you to, and they fool you. They fool you every time. Because they have you do an exercise, and they use that exercise to do some deep engagement into your life. And so the exercise was this. I want you to take this sheet of paper. You got crayons and markers, and we want you to describe on that sheet of paper or draw or do something that talks about how you're going to create a movement in your city for the gospel of Jesus. And so I'm like, oh, this is gonna be great. I can do this. So I'm drawing, and they go, okay, come up in front and you can present this to, you know, the class. And so I go up in front of the class. I was like, hey, here's what we're going to do, man. We're going to start some missional communities and we're going to do this. And it's like, great. Thanks, Justin. You can sit down. So I went and sat down. I was like, okay, that's it. And they're like, all right, Justin, come back up. And they had everyone share. This was just a big ploy to get me to share and for us to come up. And he goes, Justin, come here. And here's what he did. He took a chair. He sat a chair down. He took another chair and he pulled it across. He said, Justin, I want you to sit in this chair, and I want you to look across, and across from you is a benefactor that will fully support your ministry, but you need to share with him why he should do that. And so I sat down. I was like, hey, sir, that just want you to know, like, man, we're in Salt Lake City, and I share to this empty chair. He says, all right, Justin, here's what I want you to do. I want you to get up, and I want you to go, and I want you to sit in this chair. And I want you to tell Justin why that's not going to work. And so I started off with some easy things like, I mean, nobody likes bald guys in Utah, all right? You know, so that's not going to work. And, you know, just, and he's like, hey, you need to really speak into Justin. Like, you need to tell him why this isn't going to work. And what am I doing? I'm speaking my worst fears to myself. I'm speaking the things that I have always thought of, that have always lingered in the back of my mind, that always weighed me down feeling like, I don't know if I can do this. I just don't know that we're gonna be able to gather a group of people and that something's going to rise up in the city and that it's going to glorify the Lord. I just don't know that I'm capable of doing that. Why? Because, dude, I don't know that I'm smart enough. Intellectually, I don't know that I'm gonna be able to engage the world religions that all associate in Salt Lake City. I don't know that I'm going to be talented enough or gifted enough to be able to stand and to preach week in, week out. I just don't know. I mean, Mormon faith has been there for over 160 years and no one's made a dent in it. Why do you think you can? And I began preaching this to myself. He says, all right, come back over here. He goes, Justin, you have a lot of fears. I was like, okay, yeah. He goes, when you close yourself off to the emotion of fear, you end up closing yourself off to all emotions. You'll never experience real joy when you close yourself off to fear. Because he asked me, he says, how are you gonna handle that fear? I was like, I don't know, I don't really have time. I just gotta keep running, I gotta keep going. He's like, you're just pushing it away, you're ignoring it. You're closing yourself off emotionally. You gotta ask God for relief. And what I found in that moment is that God has loved Salt Lake City long before I got here. God has had a plan for Salt Lake City long before I got here. And there's not a methodology, there's not a church planning model, there's not the amount of books that I can go and pull down off my shelf and read that's going to give me relief, that's going to make me feel adequate to do what I'm doing here. The only thing that's going to give me relief is knowing that God's in my corner, that God has my back, and that he listens. And that's what David does. David goes to God for relief. The second thing is this. Second thing we see in this passage is we need to recognize that we've been set apart and we have the attention of the Father. We need to recognize that we've been set apart and that we have the attention of the Father. One of the things we see in this passage as he jumps into verse 2, he says, oh men, it's as if he's coming out of his closet of prayer into the conflict. So it's like he's over here and he's praying and then he's stepping out and he's remembering, oh yeah, what about all these people? And he talks to him. He says, oh men, how long shall my honor be turned into shame? How long will you love vain words and seek after lies? And he's calling them out on what he's being accused of. But here's what he does in verse 3, and I love this. Because these people, they're his enemies. And what's he doing? He begins to point them to God. He begins to point them to God. He begins to point them to the nature and character of his dad. So his whole thing is not to create just fear about his dad, but also to show him how great his dad is, and you'll probably want him to be your dad too. And that's what he does. And he goes, let me tell you why he's great. Let me tell you why he's my dad. Because he says, but no. It didn't say, but wonder, but guess. It says, no, that the Lord has set apart. Now, this word set apart, it's kind of identifies this word of being special. Like we are his. One of the things I love to do this, my wife hates doing this, but like, Black Friday after Thanksgiving. I'm a people watcher, so I love to get out and engage in Black Friday craziness. And so typically I'm not buying anything, but I love to just be there and see everything that goes on. And so one of the things, I remember one year I was buying something, and what you did is you stood in line and they gave you this sticker. And you would take this sticker, and instead of creating chaos where you run in and you're like grabbing things off shelves and trying to get it in your basket and get it to the front, you just took this sticker and you went and you put it on whatever it was that you were purchasing. So I can't remember, I think it was an electronics store, and it was like you were taking this sticker and you were going and putting it on a TV, because if you've ever seen the craziness that happens, you got people like pushing grand-sized TVs, you know, down the aisle, trying to get them up front to pay for them. So instead, they're like, okay, let's not do damage to our store. Let's give them stickers. And that sticker signifies something. You go and you put that sticker on something, it's like, that's mine. All of you who are standing here, just know that's my TV, okay? That's my TV. I'm taking it home. I paid for it. It's mine. That sticker right there. Look at the sticker, okay? And people will come up and they'll try to take your sticker. No, that's my sticker. Like, you leave it alone, all right? And they'll cut in line. I hate cutting in line. So what he's saying here is, know that the Lord has put a sticker on you. He set you apart. He's saying, hey, that's mine. That's my son. That person that you're accusing, he's mine. Not only is he mine, but he goes on and he's like, and the Lord hears when I call him. But know that the Lord has set apart the godly for himself, and the Lord hears when I call him. Do you know who my dad is? And do you know that I got his phone number? And he will come in an instant. He will answer. He goes on in verse 4. Be angry and do not sin. Ponder in your own hearts on your beds and be silent. Offer right sacrifices and put your trust in the Lord. Be angry and do not sin. Ponder it in your own hearts and your own beds and be silent. Offer right sacrifices and put your trust in the Lord. Isn't it easy when we feel like we're in that tight spot? Isn't it easy when we feel like people are slandering us, accusing us, or coming at us? Those are moments that it's easy to sin. Going back to my silly story yesterday, it would have been really easy to sin. It'd have been really easy to roll down my window and say, hey, get at the back of the line. You know, like, it would have been really easy. It'd have been really easy for me to long for God to do something. And feel like in my waiting, I just begin to doubt and go, man, God's not going to answer. What Davis tells us here is he's like, be angry. He's not saying like, it's okay to be frustrated, but don't let that frustration grow into sin. Take it home. Sit on it. Be quiet. Ponder it over as you lay your head down tonight. Think through that. Remember the character and nature of who God is, the God who wants to answer you. Put your trust in him. And what is fascinating is we find about this passage is David is actually speaking some of these words to his enemies. He's saying, you're coming at me and you're trying to get me, but you need to go home. Be angry, but don't sin. Go home, put your head down on your pillow and think through this. Offer right sacrifices. And man, doesn't that sound like Jesus, like praying for his persecutors, praying for his enemies? Jesus on the cross, he's being accused. He says, Lord, forgive them. And that's exactly what we see David do in this passage. We see David talking to, he says, don't sin. Don't allow that weight in your soul to just build up and to a point where you cause full-on anger. And then he says, there are many who say, who will show us some good? Now what he's saying in this passage is he's saying, there are many who believe there's no good out there. There's many who have just failed to hear from God for so long that they've gotten to a point where they're like, is God even good? Does God even really care? Does God even really want to answer? It's gotten to a point that they believe that all good has vanished on the earth. And David says, for those of you who question that, for those of you who question if good is still here, if good is still present, he says, lift up the light of your face upon us, O Lord. For you have put more joy in my heart than they have when their grain and wine abound. What David does here is David gets to the last point that he begins to rest in the character and nature of God for confidence and ultimate safety. David gets to a point where he's resting in the character and nature of God for confidence and ultimate safety. When all these other people are saying, what's good? What's in it for me? What do I get out of this? He's like, God, prove yourself. God, prove your character. Allow your character to light up our face. Allow people to truly experience this type of joy. Let me ask you this morning, have you experienced verse 7? It says, you have put more joy in my heart than they have when their wine and grain abound. Let me ask you, do you want to know something about that joy? Don't you want to experience that joy? David's saying, I've experienced joy that is beyond the circumstances of life. My barn can be empty of grain, and I can still have joy. I can have people accusing me, attacking me, and feeling like this situation is really closing in on me, and I can still have joy. My question to you today is, don't you want to know something about that joy? That we're all seeking, we're all desiring joy. And David tells us the joy that you're seeking, it doesn't come when you have a lot of wine, when you have a lot of grain. Those were monetary units of prosperity at this time. And so if you had a lot of wine, you had a lot of grain, you were doing well. And he's saying, even if those things do not exist, you can still experience joy. And this gives comfort to David. This comforts his heart because he's saying, although they can rob me of being king, although they can take over the throne, although they can run me out of the city, they can never take you from me. I will always have you, which means I can always have joy. I can always have joy in the midst of terrible circumstances. And this isn't just like a naive joy where you just like, I just don't want to face all this, so I'm not going to look at it and I'm just going to act like everything's okay. No, this is deep soul-giving joy. Joy that only God can give. And it's in that joy, it's in that nature and character of who God is that in verse 8 he says, again, in peace, I will both lie down and sleep. And the reason he can lie down and sleep is because for you alone, O Lord, make me dwell in safety. Now, is David saying, my life may be taken? Like, could it be that David is like, he's not necessarily saying, I may not die. Like, God, you're going to protect me and I'm not going to die. Because we could read this passage and go, for you alone, O Lord, make me dwell in safety. It's like, well, no harm's going to come upon me. And we'll take this passage and we'll believe that. And we'll claim it and we'll put it on coffee mugs and t-shirts and bumper stickers. And we'll be like, for you alone, Lord, make me dwell in safety. No harm's going to come upon me. Does harm come upon Christians? Absolutely. But the safety that he's talking about here is ultimate safety. The ultimate safety that knows we have a hope and a future. That when harm may come upon me here on earth, that no one can rob me of my soul and that no one can take me outside of the hands of God. We have ultimate safety. We have ultimate care. Matthew 10:28, it says, and do not fear those who kill the body, but cannot kill the soul. Rather, fear him who can destroy both soul and body in hell. He's saying, don't fear the fleshly people that you're sitting around this room with. Don't fear the fleshly people that you go to work with. Don't give way to their opinions. Don't fear them. There's one opinion that matters, and it's in him that you have eternal safety, ultimate safety. I love Isaiah 8:12. It says, do not fear what they fear, nor be in dread, but the Lord of hosts, him you shall honor as holy. Let him be your fear, let him be your dread, and he will become a sanctuary for you. Do you want to experience that peace, that peace that comes from knowing God as your sanctuary? It comes in knowing the nature and character of God. How do you see God? What is it that when you look at David's life and see how he views God, what differs in your life? Do you believe God to be gracious? Do you believe God to credit you with righteousness? Do you believe that what Jesus did on the cross is that he took your wrath and that his righteousness was accredited to your account? That in the atonement, we have been made righteous. Do you believe God to be good? Do you believe God to be the author of good? Do you believe that what God does is right? If so, David would tell us that your prayers reveal the nature and character of God. And the reason that David is crying out to God, the reason that David is saying, answer me when I call, hear me when I call, God, I'm crying out to you. The reason he does that, the reason he prays those things is because he believes great things when it comes to the nature and character of God. Tim Keller authored a part of The Supremacy of Christ in the Postmodern World. And he says this, he tells the story of Alexander the Great. You may have heard this before. I love the story, but it says Alexander the Great had a general whose daughter was getting married. And Alexander valued this soldier greatly and offered to pay for the wedding. When the general gave Alexander's steward the bill, it was absolutely enormous. The steward came to Alexander the Great and named the sum. And to his surprise, Alexander smiled and said, pay it. And this man was almost like outraged, like, why would this guy do this? Like, why would you answer this man's request? Why would you pay for his daughter's wedding? Like, why would you take care of this? And he says this, don't you see by asking me for such an enormous sum, he actually does me a great honor? Do you see that by asking me, he shows and believes that I am both rich and generous? That in his asking, he believes these things about me. Our request to God. It may be that we make very few requests of God is because we don't fully understand the nature and character of God, that we believe him to be gracious, that we believe him to be a great gift giver, a great dad. And there is this balance. N.T. Wright talks about it in the sense that we shouldn't necessarily have this confidence that God is going to grant every request that we ask, but we also shouldn't have this doubt that says God is not going to answer anything at all. There is a balance in this, that God is answering us and he will answer us. And sometimes the answer is no, but God is going to answer us and what he does is good. And so whatever he allows or brings into my life is good. And so how do you picture God? Because that affects your prayer life. That affects the request that you bring. Do we believe that we got a great dad in our corner? Do we believe that we have a great father? Do we believe that we have a gracious dad? Isaiah 30:18, I'll close with this. It says, therefore the Lord waits to be gracious to you, and therefore he exalts himself to show mercy to you. Now, I'm always hesitant to pull a passage out and just hold it alone here and not look at the context. And what you'll find interesting is if you go back and read Isaiah 30:1-17, it's all about Israel forsaking him, rebelling against him, and on the run from him. And in verse 18, he says, he waits to be gracious to you. He waits to have conversation with you. He waits to want to know you. It's a relationship. It's a conversation. Do you have this type of dependency upon God? Where is it that you go for safety? Is it verse 8? Do you say, for you alone are my safety? Is he your place of refuge? Let's pray together.